Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome inside ESPN Studio. Welcome to the Spencer Wilson Show. I'm your host, Spencer Wilson. I hope this Tuesday, October 29th, is treating you well. It is starting to get brisk outside. The leaves are changing all sorts of colors, and the cold season is officially setting in. And we got a fun show for you today, make you feel all warm and fuzzy about sports. We'll have some Monday Night Football reaction from our pal Terry in the Steel City. We'll have a World Series Game 6 preview, give you my thoughts on the game tonight and how it might pan out. Also give you my recap of the F1 Mexican Grand Prix that went down this weekend. And a massive change in NCAA rules that broke this morning regarding athletes and their likeness. But first, we are going to start off by talking about the NBA season, because the 2019-2020 NBA season is officially entering its second week. Week one is in the books. Some surprising turnouts, some interesting game results. So we'll take a look at the standings here. We got a couple undefeated teams through the first week. Three of them in the Western Conference. Denver, San Antonio, and Minnesota, all 3-0, all playing really well. No surprise, really, to see Denver up there. They had a good team last year. They made it to the playoffs as one of the top teams in the Western Conference. So not a surprise to see this team come out of the gate, continue to play well, and contend in this conference. Little bit surprising to see San Antonio and Minnesota both up there. I liked Minnesota. I like the young guys they have there with Wiggins and Karl-Anthony Towns. They've gotten off to a hot start with a 3-0 coming out of the gate, and they look really, really good. They look like two guys that are ready to kind of take over, same way that Embiid and Simmons are looking to kind of handle their business in Philadelphia. I feel like Wiggins and Karl-Anthony Towns are doing the same thing in Minnesota. They're ready to step up. They're ready to take this team by storm. Now that the whole Jimmy Butler storm has come and gone, that's out of the way. They're ready to stand there and take over as the two stars for this Timberwolves team. And they've done a great job of it in this first week. If you look at the team stats the first week, Minnesota is fifth in total offense in points with 121. They're third in points differential with plus 10. Also on the defensive end, they're fourth in rebounds with 50. And Karl-Anthony Towns also playing well, getting into some top fives. He's third in points per game with 32. He is fifth, or he's tied for third in rebounds with 13. And if you go down defensively, he's number one in steals with 3 a game. So Karl-Anthony Towns really getting out of the gate well, leading the way for this team. Wiggins has hit some big shots from the outside in their first couple games. So Minnesota really showing they're ready to contend this year and possibly push for a playoff spot in the West, and maybe even be one of the top four teams. The Clippers round out the top four in the West after week one. They are 3-1 after their first week. Their one loss, one of the bigger upsets of the first week of the NBA season. My boys, the Phoenix Suns, were able to top the LA Clippers on Thursday, this past Thursday. Oh, I'm sorry, that was the Golden State game. Phoenix beat them on Saturday. Say this past Saturday, Phoenix beat the Clippers 130-122 at home without the big man DeAndre Ayton out there serving his 25-game suspension for the diuretics being found in his bloodstream. Of course, that often used to shield possible steroid use as well, so it's an unfortunate situation there with Ayton, but regardless, he'll serve his penalty, and the Suns carrying on without him and doing so quite well with that win over the Clippers. And, I mean, that was arguably one of the biggest upsets of this first week. You can argue that the OKC Golden State game, while not a shock Golden State lost, probably a shock how much they were getting beaten by at some stages. But that Phoenix Clippers game, I mean, that to me is the upset of week one in the NBA. That was pretty incredible. But the Clippers still holding on with a 3-1 record, half a game back of the top three there, solidly sitting in that fourth place spot in the West. The Utah Jazz then starts that middle four in the Western Conference, and also at 3-1, half a game back. Houston, 2-1 after their first week, a game back of the leaders. And there was a lot of hubbub made about Harden and Westbrook and that kind of animated conversation they were having during their, I think it was their first game out there, or their second game. And I think it got blown out of proportion. These are two stars. You got to give them time to accommodate to each other, understand how. Because these two guys, even though they had time together in OKC, Harden left way, way before. I mean, that was still when Durant was on the team. Harden was the first of those three to leave OKC to Houston, and he's really gotten a chance to develop his game and become the kind of guy he wants to become, the kind of player he wants to be. And Westbrook has kind of gotten the chance to do that at OKC as well. When Harden and Durant left, Westbrook was the guy there, and he got a chance to really evolve his game. So now that these two guys are further along in their career, we stumble upon this problem every single year in the NBA now when these stars get together. You got to give them some time to gel. Preseason is one thing. When the games start to count for real, the tension starts to mount, and pressure starts to build throughout every game of this NBA season, you got to give guys time to accommodate and adjust to each other. I think when they do, this Houston team is going to be fine. Maybe these struggles continue and they don't make it into the top four, but I don't see any way where Westbrook and Harden stay healthy that this team doesn't make the playoffs. So sitting sixth, it's an okay start for them. I feel like it's going to get better. I feel like they're going to pressure that top four. But as of 6-2-1. Lakers and Dallas rounding out the top eight in the West. Both teams also 2-1. Nothing too special from either of those teams, but solid play throughout this first week. The Lakers with LeBron James and Anthony Davis, I think the chemistry there has looked really good to start the season. LeBron seems like he is ready to say, hey, I'm okay not being the guy. I'm going to do my part. I'm going to score some points. I'm going to dish the ball out. But AD, it is your time to really step up into the spotlight. I think Anthony Davis is relishing that right now, three games into the season. And I think this is just going to be a team that gets more and more comfortable in that kind of an aspect. And I think when LeBron really settles into this new role, this kind of second in command almost on the floor behind Anthony Davis, this team is going to continue to get better and continue to play well throughout this season. And then Dallas, hey, you're 2-1. Kristaps Porzingis is playing really well. Luka Doncic continues to kind of be consistently good in producing for this team. So if you're Dallas, you're feeling good right now, sitting in eighth coming off this first week. And looking at the bottom seven of the conference, Phoenix and Portland, 9th and 10th, both 2-2 with a game and a half back. Phoenix, like I said, that solid win over the Clippers. They also had a good win over the Kings. Tough losses to Denver and Utah this week. But they're bouncing back. They're playing well. They're carrying themselves well. I love to see the little bit of an edge that this team has, especially through Devin Booker. I feel like he's playing really well at the start of this year. He's constantly played well for this team, and Phoenix needs to do whatever they have to do to make sure that young man wants to stay in the desert. And then Memphis and Golden State, 11th and 12th, both 1-2 on the season. Memphis, nothing was really expected from them. Golden State having a much rougher start to the season, I think a lot of us, well, or at least some of us anticipated. I know there's a group of people out there that didn't expect Golden State to make the playoffs at all. I personally thought that was a little too extreme. I feel like they're going to be able to make a playoff run, but this is a very rough start for Golden State. And you know what? After the last 3-4 years that they've experienced, even the last 5 years they've experienced, this is going to be a tough drop-off. And it might feel a lot worse than it will end up being at the end of the season, but it's going to hurt. It's going to be a struggle. It's going to be a different kind of year for Warriors and the Warriors fan base than they've experienced in the recent past. So, hey, just bite down your mouthpiece, keep playing, and know that you got 79 games still left on your season, so you got plenty of time to go. And then OKC in 13th, 1-3. And then New Orleans and Sacramento, both 0-4, the two winless teams in the Western Conference, two of the three winless teams still alive in the NBA. Now we look at the Eastern Conference. Philadelphia, the lone team in first, 3-0, having a great start to the year there. As I mentioned earlier, talking about Minnesota, Philadelphia with Embiid and Simmons ready to take over and show what they can do for this team. Simmons has been leading the way nicely. Embiid's made some really solid and exciting plays for this team down low. So this looks like a team that is ready to rally around these two young guys and really push the 76ers team over the brink and possibly get back into the NBA Finals, which they have been so eager to get to since the last time they were there. Toronto in second, the defending champions, 3-1, a half a game back. Nothing too special from Toronto to start the year. They've been playing well. They've been getting good production from a lot of their players on the roster, but 3-1. I don't really expect Toronto to be anywhere else except those top two, top three spots. Miami hanging around in third, 2-1, one game back. They're having a solid start to their year. Atlanta, same thing, 2-1, a game back in fourth. Trae Young Really looks like he's enjoying himself this year. Looks like he's settled into the role more there in Atlanta. Vince Carter, I think, is really feeding off that as well. He still looks like he's having fun out there. The middle four, Boston and Milwaukee, both 2-1, one game back. Boston, maybe not looking as sharp to start the year as I thought they would. Jason Tatum still having a good year. He's in the top five in steals, right there with Karl-Anthony Towns at 3 and Ben Simmons just below him at 2.6. So he's hanging in there with those big stars in the Eastern Conference and one in the Western Conference. So Boston looking good, just not maybe as, like I said, as sharp, as crisp as we've seen. But Gordon Hayward's putting in some good minutes and some good production as well this year. So I think it's just a matter of time for Boston to get rolling, and then we'll see them as the top four team. I think they are. The Milwaukee, 2-1. They've had a good showing. They've been great at Giannis Antetokounmpo again, just playing really well out there, playing as the reigning MVP that he is. And then we got Detroit at 2-2, Orlando at 1-2, rounding out those middle four teams. Then you look at the bottom seven in the division: Washington, Brooklyn, and Cleveland, all 1-2. Nothing too special there. Brooklyn, I think, again, a little bit of a slow start, but Kyrie Irving playing really well. He had that 50 spot early in week one. Has continued to produce for this team. I think it's going to be a struggle without Kevin Durant, but I see them still picking it up, getting better, getting into that playoff spot later on in the year. Washington and Cleveland, not too much expected there from either one. Charlotte, New York, and Chicago, all 1-3 so far in the season. Again, not too surprised there by either one of those three teams not necessarily performing. Didn't expect a lot from New York, although R.J. Barrett is looking like he's getting more and more comfortable and ready to take over that city when he gets a little more emotionally and mentally matured at that level in the NBA. And then you have Indiana in last place in the East, 0-3, the only winless team in the Eastern Conference, sitting at the bottom of their division. Some of the other big games going around this week, well, that is how the Eastern Conference shapes up and is looking after week one. Some of the other games that caught my attention this week, earlier on, last Wednesday, Philadelphia and Boston played each other, Philly with a 107-93 victory. Again, I think it's just a case of Philly being a little more sharper out of the gate than Boston, but I think it was also kind of a benchmark for Philadelphia to show, hey, even early in the season, here's where we are. We're going to get better. We're going to get tougher. Milwaukee and Houston, the Bucks rallied back past Houston, 117-111 on the road. I think that was the game where Harden and Westbrook had their animated conversation, but that game really was a shining star for Milwaukee early in the season when on the road against Houston. A possible NBA Finals preview should Milwaukee and Houston really start picking it up. And it was a tough game on the road for Milwaukee, but Giannis shined through, led that team to win there on the road against Houston. And then we talked about the Golden State OKC game, but the Clippers got to Golden State first and really roughed them up, 141-122. That was kind of the start of the conversation around Golden State and how bad this season might be. And then, of course, the OKC game on Sunday, just a couple days ago, really kind of put that into perspective. I think I checked the score as they were going into the third quarter, and Golden State had 40 points, maybe 40, 43. So that was probably the ugliest game of the season so far in terms of how one team played, because Golden State just flat out got outplayed. And Steve Kerr has made comments about Curry and his three-point shooting and how to kind of manage that. And Kerr said that they can't turn him into Harden. That was the thing. They want to avoid making Steph Curry the next kind of James Harden, where all he's doing is worrying about how many threes he can get up, how, you know, the different ways he can shoot a three to make it tough for the defense, and really start to make Stephen Curry this all-around player where he's not just on transition hitting threes, but he can drive, he can hit the mid-range jumper and just try to spread that out a little bit more. And I think that is important with the fact that you don't have Klay Thompson, at least not for a majority of the season, if he manages to get back for the end of the year. But when it's Draymond, Steph leading the way, Curry's going to have to change his game up a little bit. And I think Steve Kerr, time to be a coach. Can't just sit there on the bench anymore and try to manage things in the locker room. Got to do something on the sideline. So it'll be interesting to see how he adjusts with Steph moving forward. But this is going to be, I think, a big year in the maturity and the overall type of game that Steph Curry plays in the NBA. But that's how we're looking after week one of the NBA season. It's been entertaining so far as the NHL and NFL season has been. And I can't wait to see what week two has in store. When we come back from the break, our pal Terry will join us from the Steel City to talk about Monday Night Football, and I'll also give you my thoughts on Game 6 of the World Series going down tonight in Houston. That's coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Week 8 is now officially in the books, which means Monday Night Football is come and gone, so we only have one option. That's to talk to our man on the streets, Mr. Terry Heiser, who is back in the Steel City. Terry, welcome back to the show. Did you receive a warm welcome from the Steel City fans upon your return?
Oh, just the warmest. You know them.
Standing outside with some signs for you.
I only saw a few middle fingers this time.
All right, there we go. That's an improvement.
Yeah. Well, you know, which it's the collective IQ of all Pittsburgh fans. So.
Spoken like a true Raider fan there with some nice grit. Let's start talking a little bit about this game, because the start of it, I think, caught a lot of people, or some people, somewhat off guard, because we knew it wasn't going to be a barn burner of a game, but the fact that Miami got out to a 14-0 lead at the end of the first quarter was, I think, surprising is a fair way to put it.
Yeah, it was for me. I know I saw that score, and I kind of walked out of the stadium because my car was still running, because I had to borrow a car from a friend of mine to drive from New York to Pittsburgh, because, well, let's just say the accommodations weren't as friendly as they have been in the past. So I had to borrow a car to get there, but. You know, hey, you can only do so much with a Ford Pinto anyway. So.
That's a good point. But at least you did. That's the good thing about having friends all over the place, is you were able to get a car and get yourself to Pittsburgh. And the nice thing is you will be going right back to New York, so you can give him his car right back.
Exactly. See, you're reading my mind, man. You know, I'm a good friend. I'm what they call a very good friend. I'll give it back. I only hit a couple of people on the way, so we're okay.
There you go. That's below the national average, so you're in a good spot there.
Great spot.
But let me ask you a question, Terry, because I've been talking about this on the show the last couple of weeks at least, and that is my frustration with Miami and having Fitzpatrick out there when you could have Josh Rosen out there learning your system and getting essentially a worry-free season, seeing as how you're essentially tanking this year. So do you agree with them putting Fitzpatrick out there, or are you kind of on my side, whereas you think they should have Rosen out there during these games?
I'm completely on your side. Fitzpatrick has no business being out there, because that tells me they're trying to win games if they have Fitzpatrick out there, which, I mean, come on, they're not trying. I mean, look, they traded Minka Fitzpatrick. They've, who else? They traded Tunsil.
They just traded Kenyon Drake to Arizona.
So why? Yeah, exactly. So why bring in someone who's going to try to help you win games when you could be finding out what you have with Rosen? You know, what did they give him? Two games, three games, two and a half games, something like that.
I think just two.
Yeah, and so you have no idea what you have. I don't know what's going on there. And what's not surprising is former Raiders GM Reggie McKenzie is a special consultant there in the GM's office. So that sounds about right, to be honest.
What do you think about Miami now? At least if these reports that I'm seeing are correct, they've now acquired Aqib Talib from the Los Angeles Rams. What do you make of that? Do you think that'll in any way, shape, or form help Miami moving forward this season?
Yeah, to get a worse draft pick. But I would not be surprised to see the upcoming retirement of Aqib Talib because of that.
Yeah, I'd be right there with you. It wouldn't be a very big surprise. Let's talk also about this Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback. Mason Rudolph has filled in nicely for Big Ben. It's a 3-4 Steelers team now, still hanging in there just a couple games back of Baltimore. Do you think that regardless of what happens with Ben Roethlisberger moving forward next season and beyond, do you think Mason Rudolph is done enough, or is starting to do enough to kind of put the thought in the Steelers' front office minds that he could possibly be their starting quarterback moving forward?
You know, he's a serviceable quarterback, man. I think he's got some skills. He's pushing. He might push Big Ben off the old proverbial hot, or I don't know, what am I looking for here? The motorcycle, if you will, to go back 10 years. But I think he's got a good chance to really help that franchise, which unfortunately for me is not a good thing. But I like the kid. I like watching him. He's got skills. He seems like he has a good head on his shoulders, and he's got a high football IQ. So,
and
I
then
think, I think he has a chance to do well.
And then the Pittsburgh running game is now essentially non-existent. James Conner dealing with an injury. I believe Benny Snell Jr. also was banged up after the game last night. So that means I believe Trey Edmonds is the only active running back on the Pittsburgh Steelers roster, and he had a whopping one carry for 0 yards last night. Do you think with Roethlisberger's issues and now with the running game essentially being non-existent with the injuries, is Pittsburgh just destined for kind of a 500 or a little below season with all they have to battle through?
I think it's inevitable. I wonder what Jerome Bettis is doing. I wonder if he could come back and play a little.
Why not?
Which James Conner really hurts my fantasy team, which no one cares about. I get it. But, you know, having James Conner injured is a bad thing for me because I was doing really well with him.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Terry.
Yeah, you know. R.I.P. What are you going to do?
Then I got one more question for you, Terry. There
sure.
was a lot of talk, or there's been a lot of talk now about, with the college football season getting close to kind of their last third of the season, the talk of the coaching carousel always comes up. And Mike Tomlin's name has been linked to some rumors around some high-level college teams. Could you see Tomlin trading in his Steelers hat for a collegiate hat, or do you think he's going to do what he can just to stay in Pittsburgh?
Oh, he's not going to college. You kidding me? No, he's a Pittsburgh lifer, I think. And I honestly don't think the Rooneys are going to do anything to get rid of him. Pittsburgh's had three head coaches in their entire history. Chuck Knoll, what's his name? The big jawed guy,
Bill Cowher,
Bill Cowher, and Tomlin, they don't fire coaches, and I think that is going to be the status quo. I think we'll see him next year as the Pittsburgh coach, unless he retires or resigns or something.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think the allure of college is always that you can really get in touch with players and really kind of shape them. But I think regardless of that, a coach wants to be at the highest level, and Tomlin's done everything right to be and stay at the NFL. So I agree with you. I don't see him going anywhere else besides staying in the NFL and staying with the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Yeah, I agree. I just don't see it happening. I mean, it would be kind of cool to see him be in college, but there's no way. There's no way.
Yeah. Well, Terry, thank you for your time, man. Like we said, you're going to be on your way right back to New York for the Giants and Dallas Cowboys next week, the NFC East rivalry. Any quick thoughts on what you think that game might be next week?
I think the Giants are going to give them a run. Dallas will probably win going away by two touchdowns, but I think the Giants will be in it for 2.5, 3 quarters.
Love it. Terry, thank you very much. As always, stay tough out there on the road, and we'll talk to you next week from the Big Apple.
I'll try. It's hard dodging these Pittsburgh Pittsburgh Steelers fans that take up half the road. So.
Yeah, I know. They make it tough, but I got faith in you, Terry.
All right, man. Be good.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you next week.
See ya.
Big thank you to Terry there for all of his hard work on the road. All right, no transition now, but let's talk about Game 6 of the World Series, which is going down tonight back in Houston. The Astros with a 3-2 series lead on the Nationals after winning all three games in our nation's capital at Nationals Park. I mean, that right there, it's been a series of road teams. But the game, there was one good game, one ugly game when Washington won games 1 and 2 in Houston. All three games kind of got ugly for Washington. Game 3, which I think was the 4-1 Houston win, wasn't as bad. But then 8-1, 7-1, Washington got outscored by Houston 19-3 at Nationals Park in those three games. So coming off of those three games at home, you would think that Washington's going to have a chip on their shoulder, ready to go. But the way they came out in this series and started in games one and two, you really felt like those three games at home were going to be the last chance or the chance, their best chance to win this World Series. All they had to win two out of three home games. That was it. They couldn't even win one. Now, Houston hasn't won a home game either, which really makes game six kind of perplexing because you would think that Houston now comes home with all this momentum ready to shut it out in game six, but then you look at the probable starters and you wonder because Steven Strasburg's on the mound for the Nationals and then Justin Verlander is on the mound for the Houston Astros, and his World Series resume has become very well known this postseason. He's got six starts and he's 0-5. With a 5.73 ERA, so he has struggled in these big games and big moments, which is such a head-scratcher because he's usually so good in those kind of big moments, either in the regular season or in some playoff moments working up to the World Series. And he struggled in his some of his starts against Tampa Bay and New York. I know between the three series that he's pitched in, he's allowed 9 runs in the first inning combined, so he's had an issue getting off to a good start. And this might be it. This might be the turnaround. But with Strasburg on the mound and the way that he's pitched this postseason, it makes me nervous to think that Houston can close it out tonight with Verlander on the mound. And I picked Houston in six. I'm not changing that. I haven't changed it. I doubted it after game two, but I'm not changing it, and I haven't changed it. And I believe that if Verlander is going to figure it out, it's going to be tonight. I feel like it almost has to be tonight for his resume moving forward. He's going to be a Hall of Famer, but if his World Series stats stay this way, then he's going to go into the Hall of Fame with kind of an unofficial asterisk. Like, yeah, you know, he played really well in the regular season and the playoffs leading up to the World Series, but he was just never able to get it done when it really counted. And I remember being a Giants fan, I remember that 2012 World Series and watching his start in San Francisco from my dorm room in Oregon and watching Pablo Sandoval tag him for 3 home runs in that game. There's just something about this stage and these lights that if some guys get under it, the resumes don't matter and they just struggle. Strasburg, even though he's pitched really well, is entering some uncharted territory, setting a career high in innings pitched, which is only going to go up even more after the game tonight. So that could have an effect too. But there's a part of me that says Houston at home in game six behind Verlander might not be enough. He just might not have the stuff because Houston's bats came back alive in games four and five. And if they continue to do that, it might not matter what Verlander does on the mound as long as Houston can maybe just out-hit him and outscore him in what could be a game six shootout. But I feel like it's going to be a little rocky for Houston tonight. I feel like the fan base is going to be a little on edge with how they played this first two games in the series at home. So if I'm Washington, I think I want to be even more aggressive than usual. I mean, you're already down 3-2. You're on the brink of elimination, so you're going to come out aggressive. But against a pitcher that has struggled in the World Series, against a, and really not even the World Series, he hasn't been that great this postseason either. I mean, 1-3 with a 4.15 ERA this postseason. He's been able to get out of innings and make some big pitches, but overall, he has struggled this postseason. And with the way Strasburg's been pitching, I think the way that Houston's going to come out even more aggressive at the plate, Washington might just be able to force a game seven. And if they do that, I haven't seen probable starters for those games, but if they do that, that can just send everybody into a I mean, the fun thing about game seven of the World Series is pretty much everything is off. Doesn't matter how recent you pitched. Doesn't matter what your batting average could be. They're just, you might get into a spot where you're just looking for a spark, and anybody can provide that spark in a game seven, especially in the sport of baseball. So I think tonight, Houston still has the better chance of winning because of how hot their bats have been and because it is Verlander out there. We know what the guy is capable of, and with his struggles in the World Series, I would not be surprised if he can put it together for one more big game at home. So I think if Houston wins, it's either a close shootout, so it's like 6-5 or maybe even 7-6, or it's a surprisingly, not too surprisingly, but it might be a pitcher's duel to where maybe it's 2-1 or 3-2 where Houston takes the victory. But I think it's going to be a close game. I think both pitchers are going to show up and going to make big plays. But ultimately, I think it's going to be decided by the bats. I like the way Houston's bats have been swinging. I don't think the off day yesterday is going to really affect that, especially them coming home now and feeling a little more in rhythm with this series. So I think it's going to be Houston tonight that takes it. I think I'm going to get this one prediction right this postseason. It'd be the one prediction I get completely right. Because I either get it half right, I either get the team and not the games, or I'm missing both. But if I get the World Series correct, I'm going to feel relatively good about myself this MLB postseason. So I'm hoping Houston does win tonight just so I can be right and they can win in six. But we'll see. Hopefully, nonetheless, it is just a good game. And coming up after the break, Formula One had their Mexican Grand Prix over the weekend, and it was a fun race that we thought was going to set up for a big climactic finish, and we didn't exactly get that, but we'll dive into my reaction after the break here on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
We are down to three races left on the Formula One Grand Prix schedule this year. The United States Grand Prix coming up this weekend, then Brazil and Abu Dhabi, and that'll be the season for 2019. But the Mexican Grand Prix happened this past weekend down in Mexico City, and it was an interesting race. It started, of course, with the news that Max Verstappen, who had come into the race as the two-time defending champion, winning in 2017 and 2018, had been stripped of the pole position he had won for ignoring the yellow flags when Valtteri Bottas crashed into the barrier, I think at the second-to-last turn of the lap. And Max, on the radio, supposedly admitted to seeing the yellow flags, and that's what ultimately, when he went to go see the stewards, that's ultimately what led to him definitely getting the penalty, and he got penalized three grid positions. So instead of starting on pole in first, he started in fourth instead. And really, it went from bad to worse from that point out for Max Verstappen. He had, I mean, after his frustrations in the Mexican Grand Prix qualifying last year, when he missed out, his teammate at the time, Daniel Ricciardo, managed to put in an all-time fastest lap there at the Mexican Grand Prix and was able to knock Verstappen from pole position to position number two to start the race, and that really frustrated him. And I feel like he harbored a lot of that from last year, and you saw that in qualifying this year. He was just driving like a bat out of hell, really, and just really putting the pressure on everybody, the other big six drivers, everyone else in the remainder of the field. He just made a point to really stand out and get that pole position, then, of course, getting that stripped. And starting in fourth really isn't that much of a punishment. You're still on the second row, and we've seen drivers go from third or fourth, that second row starting position, and rocket into the front of the pack. So not a super harsh penalty. It's not as obviously as great of a starting position as pole position is, but it wasn't a kind of like a dampener really for his race. He could still come out and challenge and you know, try to be a three-peat winner there for the Mexican Grand Prix. But at the start of the race, he just couldn't get out of his own way, really. I mean, Ferrari had been promoted with Verstappen's penalty. They had gotten promoted to a front-row start, so Leclerc was on pole. Vettel was second, and Hamilton right behind them in third. Then he had Verstappen in fourth, and at the lights going out, both Ferraris got pretty good starts. Hamilton got a great start and really put pressure on Leclerc there in the Ferrari at the start of the race, but Vettel was able to come over, really cut off Hamilton, pushed him onto the grass for a little bit, which allowed the two Ferraris to get ahead, and that's when Hamilton and Verstappen then touched again. Each got a little loose coming out of turn one and going into turn two. I think Hamilton may have tapped Verstappen at first, and Verstappen came back and tapped Hamilton. Both kind of went onto the grass, and really things just got worse for Max from there. I think he had to pit. He came out dead last in 20th. Still says a lot about his driving ability, though, and really how good the Red Bull car is. When he comes out of the pits in 20th and manages just to drive through the field and still finishes 6th in the race, that was extremely impressive. And again, you wonder what would have happened if he hadn't gotten in his way like that and if he hadn't collided with Lewis at the start of the race, because those are the kind of drives that we have seen from Verstappen his entire career. You think about Austria this year when he won, or Germany this year when he won, and he did a heck of a job just driving the car through traffic, and he did that again at this race when he was able to drive through the other 14 cars that were in front of him before he got back up to the rest of the quick six. And he couldn't get past as his teammate Alexander Albon, who himself had a solid race. I think it may have been one of his best races this year, whether he was on Toro Rosso or with the Red Bull team. I think this is one of his best races, holding off his teammate Max Verstappen, really to halt his charge through the field after Max had caught him there with about, maybe five or six laps to go. But then the top four was, again, a showing of Mercedes strategy and Ferrari strategy. Ferrari just hasn't seemed to get it right really at any race this season between both of their drivers. I mean, if you look at Mercedes' strategy, I think it always favors a little bit more towards Hamilton, but the guy's the best driver in the field, so why wouldn't you lean a little bit towards him, especially when he has the points lead on his teammate Valtteri Bottas? But even Mercedes leaning a little bit more towards Hamilton in their strategy still makes sure not to completely leave Valtteri Bottas out to dry. They still make sure that he's set up with a winning car and a strategy that if Hamilton were to fall off a little bit, Bottas could step in and immediately start to challenge for the lead of the race. And they did that again in Mexico, and Ferrari again fumbled it and couldn't get it completely right. They ended up having to sacrifice Charles Leclerc to try and disrupt Mercedes in their strategy, and they couldn't do it. And that left Vettel out there in second trying to chase down Hamilton. And he couldn't get that job completed at all. And Leclerc did manage to get the fastest lap at the end of the race. But that, was just I don't even know if you can call that any kind of consolation prize at this point, with how frustrating it has been for these two Ferrari drivers this year to try and get on the same page with their team about strategy. I mean, you look back at the Chinese Grand Prix or the Azerbaijan Grand Prix, there was a lot of frustration there early in the season. Then you look at Singapore this year, the Singapore Grand Prix, there was a lot of frustration again from Leclerc. So it just seems like Ferrari hasn't been able to really manage the balance between their four-time world champion in Sebastian Vettel and the new hotshot on scene in Charles Leclerc. Because you have two guys that are at different points in their career, both trying to stay on top, both trying to get a little bit of favoritism and strategy, and Ferrari hasn't been able to really cool that heat down at all between the two. And both drivers saying, it's over, it's done, we're not, there's no problem between us anymore. And that's good for them to get that out publicly. I doubt that really still internally. I feel like those two guys still hold a little bit of harsh feelings toward each other with the fact they haven't really worked and helped each other out at all this season, really. I mean, it's either been Vettel outdoing his thing or Leclerc outdoing his thing, and I think Ferrari is now turned to just trying to keep one or the other out of each other's way. Here's what we're doing with Leclerc. Let's make sure Vettel doesn't, come anywhere near him. Here's what we're going to do with Vettel. Let's make sure Leclerc is off doing his own thing. And that's an okay quick fix. I think for the rest of the season, that's okay. But when you're going into this offseason, into the winter break, you got to try and sit down with both drivers and really work something out, because both of these guys are on contract to come back for Ferrari next year. Ferrari expects to have Vettel and Leclerc back in those cars for the 2020 season. And after this year, you cannot have a repeat of races next year. After Leclerc has shown you that he can drive this car to victory lane, he should have won the Bahrain Grand Prix. Of course, his car quit on him then. He should have won the Singapore Grand Prix, but again, a little bit of favoritism towards Vettel allowed him to win the race. He lost out to Verstappen at the Austrian Grand Prix in just flat-out racing terms. But then you look at the races he has won when he started the second half of the season, winning in Belgium and Italy, two dominant races, two great drives from Leclerc. So Ferrari has a car, and they have two drivers that could get them a double championship. They could get the Constructors and the Drivers' Championship next year, but you have to be able to manage the heat between these two drivers moving forward. You can't look at a quick fix because there isn't a quick fix. When you have 21 races on the calendar, and next year you're going to have 22 races on the calendar, when you have that kind of a long season, things tend to simmer. Things tend to just hang around if you don't address them. So if you're Ferrari, this off season, you have to address your issue between the drivers. I'm all for no orders. No driver one, no driver two. I'm almost to a point where you say, hey, let the strategists separate a little bit. Instead of having one kind of team meeting and having one kind of strategy, you know, group of your team, let there kind of be two mini strategy teams and let one work just for Leclerc and one work just for Vettel. And then Mattia Binotto is just going to kind of have to be the mediator between the two. Because if one driver gets mad that one, the other driver's strategy team is maybe doing a little better, getting a little more creative, it's going to be up to Mattia Binotto to step in and be like, hey, listen, this is what we've chosen to do because of how last year went, so we got to stick with it. Or if you're going to stick to just one overall team of strategists for Ferrari, you've got to sit down with both drivers, not individually, but at the same time, and make sure that everybody gets everything off their chest and everybody's on the same page moving forward. Because Mercedes hasn't shown any signs of slowing down with their sixth straight Constructor and Drivers' Championship. So if Ferrari wants to compete next year, you have to get it figured out. Because races like Singapore, races like Azerbaijan, races like even the one in Mexico, where there wasn't a whole lot of comfort in strategy. Vettel talked back a lot to the team, saying, you know, kind of questioning their strategy and ultimately, I think, kind of influencing what they went with. I think Leclerc was frustrated again that he was kind of the sacrificial lamb of the race, trying to get Vettel ahead of Hamilton or trying to disrupt Bottas so that Mercedes wasn't going to get two drivers on the podium. But either way, Ferrari has come up short this year against Mercedes in more ways than one. And moving forward, those problems do have solutions that you can get to quickly, but it's going to take a team effort, not just two drivers saying, okay, yeah, everything's fine. You got to sit down and got to figure it out. And then moving forward to the other big headline coming out of Mexico, the drivers' championship battle continues to the United States. Hamilton needed to outscore Valtteri Bottas by 14 points in Mexico. He only outscored him by 10. So Valtteri Bottas still barely alive in the championship hunt. He's going to have to essentially get the maximum 26 points out of the last three races and hopes that Hamilton finishes 10th or just finishes and doesn't score at all. Because essentially, all Hamilton has to do is just outscore him in Austin and it's over. Valtteri was 4 points clear of the line coming out of Mexico. And, if you want to look at how Lewis would have to outscore him, if Valtteri doesn't finish, right, if either he crashes out or his engine quits or he just doesn't have that good of a drive in the United States, let's say he finishes 11th or back, Lewis would only need to finish 8th to get 4 points and easily win the title. So Valtteri Bottas is going to have the three races of his life to end the season and hope that he gets a little help from the rest of the field to possibly push Hamilton back and, you know, still give himself a chance to win the title in the Drivers' Championship. Because right now, it's essentially just wrapped up with a nice little bow on it for Lewis Hamilton moving forward to the United States Grand Prix. And as much as I would like to see the Drivers' Championship extend all the way to the end of the season in Abu Dhabi, if I had to pick a track for the Drivers' Championship to be decided, I'd love to see it decided here in the United States. It's a little bit of a bummer that it's going to be Hamilton again. I mean, take your hat off to the guy. He is the best driver in Formula One. He's got the best car in Formula One. So he's able to get out there and essentially just tame the beast on the circuits week in and week out. But I'd love to see the Drivers' Championship clinched in the United States. I think that would be cool for this U.S. crowd, a crowd that continues to build in interest and fandom for Formula One. I think they're really starting to get into what this sport has to offer, the strategy of it, the passion behind it, and to see the Drivers' Championship decided at the Circuit of the Americas in Austin, Texas, I think would be a lot of fun. So part of me hopes that Valtteri Bottas can outscore Hamilton enough to keep it going into Brazil. Another part of me hopes that I can see the Drivers' Championship decided here in my country at the the United States Grand Prix, because that would be, that'd be a cool sight. After last year, it being decided in Mexico, be cool to see it decided up here now in the United States and just have North America kind of be the title decider for the last couple of seasons. But we'll see what happens. Hamilton has had tremendous amounts of success in the United States Grand Prix, as has Mercedes in general. Of course, Kimi Raikkonen is the defending champion, winning last year's United States Grand Prix. It was his final win for Ferrari. So we'll see if maybe the Alfa Romeo driver now has something up his sleeves, or if Vettel or maybe Leclerc can steal something in the United States Grand Prix. But we'll talk about that more on Friday. Coming up after the break, I'm going to give you my two cents worth on the NCAA changing its mind on allowing athletes to profit off their likeness and image. That's coming up after the break here on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Yes, it is. The NCAA has announced that they are going to start the process and start figuring out how they can have collegiate athletes start to profit off their names, images, and likeness. And this story broke today. I'm looking at I read the article by Dan Murphy, who is a staff writer for ESPN, just kind of looking at some bullet points back through it now. But this is huge. I think this is a move that we all saw coming sooner rather than later after California made their big announcement earlier this year that they were going to look to pass a bill that allowed college athletes to profit. Florida, the state of Florida came out and said the same thing, same did with the state of Ohio, and a couple other states started coming out and saying they were going to look at those options. And that's smart. I think that you're going to have to figure out a way to do it in the way that the board chairman of the NCAA, Mr. Michael Drake, sent out a press release or a comment on this, basically saying we must embrace change to provide the best possible experience for college athletes. And he added, additional flexibility in this area can and must continue to support college sports as a part of higher education. And I think you do have to continue to make the distinction between college and pro, but I think that distinction is going to be clear enough because not everybody is going to be able to make money, and that's been another topic or another part of this topic is that this is really only going to affect a handful of athletes at a Division I level because not everybody is going to get this opportunity, not every sport's going to get this opportunity, but it is smart to try and lay this out from a national standpoint. Instead of letting each state do their own thing, which, if that is the case, you are absolutely going to get a recruiting and performance advantage. So from the NCAA's point of view, this is smart to just kind of wave the white flag and say, listen, college athletes should profit off their image and likeness, but let us take some time to set this up so that we have a national guideline for every state and all the colleges involved so that no one gets a specific advantage. That's smart. It's the best way to do it. It's long overdue, and it's going to be interesting to see. They're shooting for January 2021 to get everything finalized, so we'll see if they can make it, but I like the move. I like this. I like it moving forward, and I hope that it all works out in the future here in the next couple years. That's the show. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed it. Tomorrow we'll look at the NHL weekly update. We'll take a look at the World Series Game 6 and if we're getting ready for a Game 7 and some other fun things on the docket. I hope you tune in tomorrow at 2, and we'll talk then. Have a good rest of your Tuesday, everybody. Peace.